Marlowe is one of the pleasantest river centres I know of. It is a bustling, lively little town. Not very picturesque on the whole, it is true, but there are many quaint nooks and corners to be found in it. There is lovely country round about it, too, if, after boating, you're fond of a walk, while the river itself is at its best here. Down to Cookham, past the Quarry Woods and the meadows, is a lovely reach. Dear old Quarry Woods, with your narrow climbing paths and your little winding glades, how scented to this hour you seem with memories of sunny summer days. How haunted are your shadowy vistas with the ghosts of laughing faces. How from your whispering leaves there softly fall the voices of long ago. From Marlowe up to Sunning is even fairer yet. Grand old Bisham Abbey, whose stone walls have rung to the shouts of the Knights Templars, and which at one time was the home of Anne of Cleves, and at another of Queen Elizabeth, is passed on the right bank just half a mile above Marlowe Bridge. From Medmenham to sweet Hambledon Lock, the river is full of peaceful beauty. But after it passes Greenlands, the rather uninteresting-looking river residence of my newsagent, a quiet, unassuming old gentleman, who may often be met with about these regions during the summer months, sculling himself along in easy, vigorous style, or chatting genially to some old lock-keeper as he passes through, until well the other side of Henley, it is somewhat bare and dull. We got up tolerably early on Monday morning at Marlowe, and went for a bathe before breakfast. And coming back, Montmorency made an awful ass of himself. The only subject on which Montmorency and I have any serious difference of opinions is cats. I like cats. Montmorency does not. When I meet a cat, I say, "Oh, poor pussy," and stoop down and tickle the side of its head, and the cat sticks up its tail in a rigid, cast-iron manner, arches its back, and wipes its nose up against my trousers. And all is gentleness and peace. When Montmorency meets a cat, the whole street knows about it, and there is enough bad language wasted in 10 seconds to last an ordinary respectable man all his life with care. I do not blame the dog, contenting myself as a rule with merely clouting his head or throwing stones at him, because I take it that that is his nature. Fox terriers are born with about 4 times as much original sin in them as other dogs are, and therefore I do not blame Montmorency for his tendency to row with cats. But he wished he had not given way to it that morning. We were, as I have said, returning from a dip, and halfway up the high street a cat darted out from one of the houses in front of us and began to trot across the road. Montmorency gave a cry of joy, the cry of a stern warrior who sees his enemy given over to his hands, the sort of cry Cromwell might have uttered when the Scots came down the hill, and flew after his prey. His victim was a large black tom. I never saw a larger cat, nor a more disreputable-looking cat. It had lost half its tail, one of its ears, and a fairly appreciable proportion of its nose. It was a long, sinewy-looking animal. It had a calm, contented air about it. Montmorency went for that poor cat at the rate of 20 miles an hour. But the cat did not hurry up, did not seem to have grasped the idea that its life was in danger. It trotted quietly on until its would-be assassin was within a yard of it, and then it turned round and sat down in the middle of the road and looked at Montmorency with a gentle, inquiring expression that said, "Yes, you want me?" Montmorency does not lack pluck, but there was something about the look of that cat that might have chilled the heart of the boldest dog. He stopped abruptly and looked back at Tom. Neither spoke, but the conversation that one could imagine was clearly as follows. The cat: "Can I do anything for you?" Montmorency: No. No, thanks." The cat: "Don't you mind speaking if you really want anything, you know?" Montmorency, backing down the high street: "Oh, no, not at all. Certainly. Don't trouble. I'm afraid I've made a mistake. I thought I knew you. Sorry I disturbed you." The cat: Not at all. Quite a pleasure. Sure you don't want anything now? Montmorency still backing. Not at all, thanks. Not at all. Very kind of you. Good morning. The cat. Good morning. Then the cat rose and continued his trot, and Montmorency, fitting what he calls his tail carefully into its groove, came back to us and took up an unimportant position in the rear. To this day, if you say the word cats to Montmorency, he will visibly shrink and look up piteously at you as if to say, please don't. We did our marketing after breakfast and revictualled the boat for 3 days. George said we ought to take vegetables, that it was unhealthy not to eat vegetables. He said they were easy enough to cook, and that he would see to that. So we got 10 pounds of potatoes, a bushel of peas, and a few cabbages. We got a beefsteak pie, a couple of gooseberry tarts, and a leg of mutton from the hotel. And fruit, and cakes, and bread and butter, and jam, and bacon and eggs, and other things we foraged around the town for. Our departure from Marlowe I regard as one of our greatest successes. It was dignified and impressive without being ostentatious. We had insisted at all the shops we'd been to that the things would be sent with us then and there. None of your, yes, sir, I will send them off at once. The boy will be down there before you are, sir, and then fooling about on the landing stage and going back to the shop twice to have a row about them for us. We waited while the basket was packed and took the boy with us. We went to a good many shops, adopting this principle at each one, and the consequence was that by the time we'd finished, we had as fine a collection of boys with baskets following us around as heart could desire. And our final march down the middle of the high street to the river must have been as imposing a spectacle as Marlowe had seen for many a long day. The order of the procession was as follows. Montmorency carrying a stick. 2 disreputable-looking curs, friends of Montmorency's. George, carrying coats and rugs and smoking a short pipe. Harris, trying to walk with easy grace while carrying a bulged-out Gladstone bag in one hand and a bottle of lime juice in the other. Greengrocer's boy and baker's boy with baskets. Boots from the hotel, carrying hamper. Confectioner's boy with basket. Grocer's boy with basket. Long-haired dog. Cheesemonger's boy with basket. Odd man carrying a bag. Bosom companion of odd man with his hands in his pockets, smoking a short clay. Fruiterer's boy with basket. Myself carrying 3 hats and a pair of boots and trying to look as if I didn't know it. 6 small boys and 4 stray dogs. When we got down to the landing stage, the boatman said, let me see, sir, was yours a steam launch or a houseboat? On our informing him it was a double-sculling skiff, he seemed surprised. Halfway up the backwater, we got out and lunched on beefsteak pie. We caught a breeze after lunch, which took us gently up past Wargrave and Shiplake. Mellowed in the drowsy sunlight of a summer's afternoon, Wargrave, nestling where the river bends, makes a sweet old picture as you pass it, and one that lingers upon the retina of memory. Shiplake is a pretty village, but it cannot be seen from the river, being upon the hill. Tennyson was married in Shiplake Church. The river, up to Sunning, winds in and out through many islands, and is very placid, hushed and lonely. Few folk, except at twilight, a pair or two of rustic lovers walking along its banks. We got out at Sunning and went for a walk round the village. It is the most fairy-like little nook on the whole river. It is more like a stage village than one built of bricks and mortar. Every house is smothered in roses, and now, in early June, they were bursting forth in clouds of dainty splendour. We roamed about Sweet Sunning for an hour or so, and then, it being too late to push on past Reading, we decided to go back to one of the Shiplake Islands and put up there for the night. It was still early when we got settled, and George said that, as we had plenty of time, it would be a splendid opportunity to try a good slap-up supper. He said he would show us what could be done up the river in the way of cooking, and suggested that, with the vegetables and the remains of the cold beef and general odds and ends, we should make an Irish stew. It seemed a fascinating idea. George gathered wood and made a fire, and Harris and I started to peel the potatoes. I should never have thought that peeling potatoes was such an undertaking. The job turned out to be the biggest thing of its kind that I'd ever been in. We began cheerfully, one might almost say skittishly, but our light-heartedness was gone by the time the first potato was finished. The more we peeled, the more peel there seemed to be left on. By the time we'd got all the peel off and all the eyes out, there was no potato left, at least none worth speaking of. George came and had a look at it. It was about the size of a peanut. He said, "Oh, that won't do. You're wasting them. You must scrape them." So we scraped them, and that was harder work than peeling. They're such an extraordinary shape, potatoes, all bumps and warts and hollows. We worked steadily for 5 and 20 minutes and did 4 potatoes. Then we struck. We said we should require the rest of the evening for scraping ourselves. I never saw such a thing as potato scraping for making a fellow in a mess. It seemed difficult to believe that the potato scrapings in which Harris and I stood half smothered could have come from 4 potatoes. It shows you what can be done with economy and care. George said it was absurd to have only 4 potatoes in an Irish stew, so we washed 6 or so more and put them in without peeling. We also put in a cabbage and about 1/2 peck of peas. George stirred it all up, and then he said that there seemed to be a lot of room to spare, so we overhauled both the hampers and picked out all the odds and ends and the remnants and added them to the stew. There were 1/2 pork pie and a bit of cold boiled bacon left. We put them in. Then George found 1/2 tin of potted salmon, and he emptied that into the pot. He said that was the advantage of Irish stew. You got rid of such a lot of things. I fished out 2 eggs that had got cracked, and we put those in, and George said that they would thicken the gravy. I forget the other ingredients, but I know nothing was wasted. And I remember that, towards the end, Montmorency, who had evinced great interest in the proceedings throughout, strolled away with an earnest and thoughtful air, reappearing a few minutes afterwards with a dead water rat in his mouth, which he evidently wished to present as his contribution to the dinner. Whether in a sarcastic spirit or with a genuine desire to assist, I cannot say. It was a great success, that Irish stew. I don't think I ever enjoyed a meal more. There was something so fresh and piquant about it. One's palate gets so tired of the old hackneyed things. Here was a dish with a new flavour, with a taste like nothing else on earth. And it was nourishing, too. As George said, there was good stuff in it. The peas and potatoes might have been a bit softer, but we all had good teeth, so that didn't matter much. And as for the gravy, it was a poem. A little too rich, perhaps, for a weak stomach, but nutritious. We finished up with tea and cherry tart. George got out his banjo after supper and wanted to play it, but Harris objected. He said he'd got a headache and didn't feel strong enough to stand it. George thought the music might do him good, said music often soothed the nerves and took away a headache, and he twanged 2 or 3 notes just to show Harris what it was like. Harris said he would rather have the headache. George has never learned to play the banjo to this day. He's had too much all-round discouragement to meet. He tried on 2 or 3 evenings while we were up the river to get a little practice, but it was never a success. Harris's language used to be enough to unnerve any man, added to which Montmorency would sit and howl steadily right through the performance. It was not giving the man a fair chance. "What's he want to howl like that for when I'm playing?" George would exclaim indignantly while taking aim at him with a boot. "What do you want to play like that for when he's howling?" Harris would retort, catching the boot. "You let him alone. He can't help howling. He's got a musical ear, and your playing makes him howl." Harris was disagreeable after supper. I think it must have been the stew that had upset him. He's not used to high living. So George and I left him in the boat and settled to go for a mooch around Henley. He said he'd have a glass of whiskey and a pipe and fix things up for the night. We were to shout when we returned, and he would row over from the island to fetch us. "Don't go to sleep, old man," we said as we started. "Not much fear of that while this stew is on," he grunted as he pulled back to the island. Henley was getting ready for the regatta and was full of bustle. We met a goodish number of men we knew about the town, and in their pleasant company the time slipped by somewhat quickly, so that it was nearly 11 o'clock before we set off on our 4-mile walk home, as we had learned to call our little craft by this time. It was a dismal night, coldish, with a thin rain falling, and as we trudged through the dark, silent fields, talking low to each other, and wondering if we were going right or not, we thought of the cosy boat, with the bright lights streaming through the tight-drawn canvas, of Harris and Montmorency and the whiskey, and wished that we were there. We struck the towpath at length, and that made us happy, because prior to this we had been not sure whether we were walking towards the river or away from it, and when you're tired and want to go to bed, uncertainties like that worry you. We passed Shiplake as the clock was striking the 11:45, and then George said thoughtfully, "You don't happen to remember which of the islands it was, do you?" "No," I replied, beginning to grow thoughtful too. "I don't. How many are there?" "Only 4," answered George. "It'll be all right if he's awake." "And if not?" I queried. But we dismissed that train of thought. We shouted when we came opposite the first island, but there was no response. So we went to the second and tried there, and obtained the same result. "Oh, I remember now," said George. "It was the third one." And we ran hopefully to the third one and halloed. No answer. The case was becoming serious. It was now past midnight. The hotels at Shiplake and Henley would be crammed, and we could not go round knocking up cottagers and householders in the middle of the night to know if they let apartments. George suggested walking back to Henley and assaulting a policeman, and so getting a night's lodging in the station house. But then there was the thought, suppose he only hits us back and refuses to lock us up. We couldn't pass the whole night fighting policemen. Besides, we didn't want to overdo the thing and get 6 months. We despairingly tried what seemed in the darkness to be the fourth island, but met with no better success. The rain was coming down fast now, and evidently meant to last. We were wet to the skin and cold and miserable. We began to wonder whether there were only 4 islands or more, or whether we were near the islands at all, or whether we were anywhere within a mile of where we ought to be, or in the wrong part of the river altogether. Everything looked so strange and different in the darkness. We began to understand the sufferings of the babes in the wood. Just when we'd given up all hope. Yes, 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 I know that that's always the time that things do happen in novels and tales, but I can't help it. I resolved, when I began to write this book, that I would be strictly truthful in all things, and so I will be, even if I have to employ hackneyed phrases for the purpose. It was just when we had given up all hope, and I must therefore say so. Just when we had given up all hope, then, I suddenly caught sight, a little way below us, of a strange, weird sort of glimmer flickering amongst the trees on the opposite bank. For an instant, I thought of ghosts. It was such a shadowy, mysterious light. The next moment, it flashed across me that it was our boat, and I sent up such a yell across the water that made the night seem to shake in its bed. We waited, breathless, for a minute, and then, oh, divinest of music of the darkness, we heard the answering bark of Montmorency. We shouted back loud enough to wake the 7 sleepers. I never could understand why it should take more noise to wake 7 sleepers than 1. And after what seemed an hour, but was really, I suppose, about 5 minutes, we saw the lighted boat creeping slowly over the blackness and heard Harris's sleepy voice asking where we were.